This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to More Than Amused Podcast, a podcast all about women and the arts, hosted by Stani and Sadie.
Join us as we explore what it's like being a female artist, examine modern day problems, and educate ourselves and you on important and forgotten female artists of the past. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to More Than a Muse. I'm Stani.
I'm Sadie, and welcome. I've been so excited for this episode for a long time because today we're covering an artist that I discovered and I found that I'm really excited to finally get the chance to talk about. Do we have anything we should say first, or can I just start talking about who we're covering today?
I don't think so. I mean, like, if you missed them, which would honestly be very surprising, we did just finish our two-part Barbie episode, if you're listening to this. Mm-hmm. And so if you've seen the movie recently or you're about to go see it and we're waiting for the hype to die down a little, then check out the episodes. We got a lot of rave reviews on the first one about, you know, the history of Barbie. And then, mm-hmm. of course, covering our movie reactions in the next one. So check them out.
Check them out. Okay, amazing. So today for my artist, I'm covering Ursula Parrott. And I found her through a very fun way. So I have a bookshop right next to where I live in Nashville that I love it. It's my favorite bookshop ever. And anyways, I was browsing, you know, as my favorite activity is to go to bookstores and browse. Mm-hmm. And I found this book called Ex-Wife by Ursula Parrott. And on the back, it says, an instant bestseller when it was published anonymously in 1929, the story of divorce and its aftermath, which scandalized the jazz era. Which, like,
love it.
What a sell. And first off, I was just like, wait. It was published anonymously in the 20s and it ended up being a woman that wrote it.
Well, yeah, we know that quote for most of history. Anonymous was a woman.
Exactly. Anyways, this book sold 100,000 copies in its first year. Like,
man,
this woman was a multimillionaire because of her writing and because of her books. Like, truly insane. She had movies based on her books, and like, I'll talk about it, but the books that went on to, like, the screenplays that were based on her books, the leading lady would end up winning Oscars, like, wow, in their roles. So this woman wrote so many books. I had never heard of this, and then I obviously bought the book because I was intrigued, and I read it and I loved it. I was almost so surprised by how much I loved it. I think in my head, I still kind of have like the old stigma of like classics equals boring, you know? Mm. And reading it, it was so interesting to me how truly modern it felt. I'm going to read the front cover real quick for you. I'm going to talk more about Ex-Wife in a sec later, obviously, in the episode. But just to give the spiel of what Ex-Wife's about. It's 1924 and Peter and Patricia have what looks to be a very modern marriage. Both drink, both smoke, both work. Patricia as a head copywriter as a major department store. When it comes to sex with other people, both believe in honesty policy until they don't, or at least until Peter doesn't. And a shell-shocked, lovesick Patricia finds herself starting out all over again, but this time around as a different kind of single woman, the ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically what happens, is he's unfaithful to her in their marriage. She forgives him. He does it multiple times. And then she is unfaithful once. And he says, I can't look at you. You're disgusting. I'm leaving you. And anyways, I'll talk about the book later. But to start off, I'm already so worried about how potentially short this episode is going to be. But that is just an unfortunate reality of when you are covering women that are unsung heroes, is there's not tons and tons of research available about them. I will say, though, I think that we're hopefully at the beginning of an Ursula Parrott renaissance, in the sense that this copy that I have was recently just published or republished in May of this year, I believe. So it's, you know, finally being published again. And by the way, the cover is beautiful. Look at it.
Aha. Ooh.
Yes.
I'm a sucker for good cover art.
Uh-huh. It is very
good. We might end up buying it.
The cover image is Art Deco or Modern Girl Dancing woodblock print ink. I think this was done in 1932. So right around the time that this was done. But yeah, anyways, the artwork on the cover is beautiful, which is obviously very eye-catching as well.
Yes.
But anyways, when I was researching her, like, her Wikipedia article is so small and so short. All the articles I was finding online were really, really short. But I discovered that as of April of this year, a biography was written about her by a Marcia Gordon, Becoming the Ex-Wife, The Unconventional Life and Forgotten Writings of Ursula Parrott. And so I found that she had written this autobiography. I was able to read the entirety of Ex-Wife. I unfortunately didn't get the chance to read the autobiography, but it is on my like to read list now. I would absolutely love to know more about her. But, you know, as we discussed many a times before, we can't read full autobiographies for every or full biographies every time.
I really, really wish we could. One day, if we reach a point, you know, where we're only podcasting, maybe
we will do
that
it.
Would be possible.
Yes. But, but for now, we are at least here to introduce the artist to you, welcome her to your brain, and so that you can be aware of her books. And if you want to learn more, there's a whole book that you can read that was just published this year a couple months ago. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. But it was really like awesome too, just because as I was researching her, because I found this book like over a month ago and have known that I was going to be doing it, but like the beginning of July, Marcia Gordon had published an article about her like on a Literary Hub website. So it was almost like as I was doing research for her, I was finding new articles that were being published like in that time from when I started researching to when I ended, which was, like I said, it made me hopeful that we're at the beginning of a Ursula Parrott Renaissance, and hopefully there is more out there in the future. But for now, I'm just glad that we get to be a part of it, because like I said, I was shocked. I didn't know anything about her, and it's the tale as old as time as far as what we covered on the podcast of were so famous in their lifetime, and then they weren't.
It does continue to baffle me though, like you talk about the Jazz Age, we've got F. Scott Fitzgerald, and then her, and apparently they're both very accomplished, very rich, selling books, and yet his name goes on to be read in every single English class, and
her name
fades away.
Exactly. And as I was trying to like figure out ways to potentially like prolong this episode or dive into other things as far as just research goes, I tried even just like searching Jazz Age women authors, Jazz Age woman, Jazz Age, you know, all kinds of things. I was only getting the Fitzgeralds. Like, second, third pages of Google, and it was just like, okay, I don't feel like I'm gonna be getting anything here. And it was frustrating because I'm like, who else was even there that has now been totally eclipsed?
So true.
By The Great Gatsby. Nothing against The Great Gatsby. I know it's a good book. Isn't that your favorite book?
Yeah, for a long time it was. I really, really love it. I don't know, like, I have a thing now where I'm like, it shouldn't be a man's book. You know what I mean? Or like, I don't know if that's great or not, that I'm like, I want to find a favorite book written by a woman instead.
Like, we're doing this podcast, we can't like things that men have
exactly
done.
But I do really love that book for the narrative it tells, but also the way it tells it. It's like a very beautifully written, but I don't feel like the story suffers, and it's hard to find a balance like that where it's like, it's pretty language but like still a good plot, you know?
I 100% agree. Fine. We appreciate art by men. Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Plus, if we believe the rumors, there's some potential there that The Great Gatsby actually started out as a Zelda Fitzgerald novel.
That's so
taken off by
very true.
So maybe I'll just tell myself that to make myself feel better.
There we go. Future episode incoming.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Let's dive into Ursula and what we know about her. Like I said, I was able to find a lot of more recent articles, like the New York Times and New Yorker have done really great articles summarizing her. But to do it briefly, and apologies in advance if this episode feels disjointed, but Ursula Parrott was born March 26th of 19. She was an American writer of romantic novels, and her first book, Ex-Wife, like I mentioned, was her most popular work and bestseller, and was adapted for a film as The Divorcee, starring Norma Shearer, and she ended up winning the Oscar for like lead actress for her role in that movie, which is really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But a little bit about her personal life. So she was born Catherine Ursula Towell in Massachusetts. Her father was Dr. Henry Towell, and her mother was Towell's second wife, Mary Catherine Flusk. She graduated from Radcliffe College, which is a small women's liberal arts college in Cambridge. And after graduation, she moved to Greenwich Village, where she met Lindsay Mark Parrott in 1920.
Another Greenwich Village resident.
I know. Wow. I'm pretty sure both of our artists that we covered in June had a Greenwich Village.
Yes, they did.
Yep.
And so there's another.
Listen,
it's the place to be. It's making me feel a little jealous. I'm like, should I be moving to Greenwich Village?
I think so. All of the artists from the 20th century, I can almost guarantee they were in Greenwich Village at some time.
That's so funny.
So like I mentioned, she married Lindsay Mark Parrott, who at the time was a reporter for the New York Times. They married in 1922. They had a son named Lindsay Mark Parrott Jr. 2 years later. Okay, so this... I don't know how, and I don't know why. So his existence, her son, was kept a secret from her husband, as he never wanted to have a son.
Like, just a son or children in general?
I don't know. And I'm also, like I said, there were, in the research that was available online, I'm sure the biography that's written maybe goes into this. Yeah. But I had a lot of times where I was like, but why? Mm-hmm. And I could not figure out why. And how? Like, were they like long distance and not really close? Because, I mean, like, you hiding a 9-month pregnant belly and like going to the hospital, like that just doesn't seem like a casual thing.
No, it doesn't. Wouldn't that be really, really interesting if there was a man who didn't want a son but wanted daughters?
That's very true. I'm going to assume he just didn't want children because...
Yeah.
That just doesn't even make sense.
The likelihood of that would be really rare.
But maybe. Anyways, so Ursula, she left the child in the custody of her father and her sister and then returned to her husband, still just not speaking a word about the son. It was until 1924, 2 years later, that Lindsay found out that he was a father. As a result, he immediately divorced her, rejected the existence of his son, never once went to see him. So actually now I'm wondering, it's like if they married in 1922, maybe it was like she had the baby right before they got married or something.
That seems a really extreme reaction though. Like, wouldn't you want to at least meet them?
Not if you're a bad person, I guess. I don't know.
Goodness.
Maybe that's a harsh judgment to cast.
I know. But I mean, it wouldn't be the first time we've talked about a real winner of a spouse on here.
That's so true. Not a winner here. But anyways, so... That's why she gets divorced, is because he didn't want a son. He finds out that there is a son and he leaves her immediately. And she still saw her son often. She brought him gifts, paid for his like Harvard education. But I'm pretty sure he stayed mainly in the custody of his sister and her dad for the majority of his life. It was actually really interesting because in the book, the... afterward to the 1989 edition of this book was actually written by her son, and it was really interesting thing to read. Like, there's a line in here, it's like, what's certain to me is she was always trouble prone. So it seems like he has a very complicated relationship with his mom, but I think all in all he did remain to like admire her, which I think is a good thing, you know, or at least admired her for what he was able to, not to like put words in his mouth, but that's what I gathered at least from the words he said. So since they divorced, she married 3 other men while she simultaneously continued to stay involved with her second husband, Charles T. Greenwood, who was a prominent New York banker. In 1934, she married John Wildberg, who was an attorney. And then in 1937, an Air Force Major Coster Schermerhorn. In 1945, she actually, fun fact, was also rumored to have had affairs with F. Scott Fitzgerald and Sinclair Lewis.
Wouldn't be shocking.
Wouldn't be shocking. And also just is a shame that F. Scott Fitzgerald is the only author apparently that anyone cares about from the Jazz Age. So whatever. Another just like weird thing that I discovered about her is that in December of 1942, she became the subject of national coverage when she was brought up on federal charges of attempting to help the jazz guitarist Michael Neely Bryan escape from the Miami Beach Army stockade. But she was actually found innocent by the jury at her trial. I think the soldier was accused of trafficking in marijuana. And she helped him get free. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a crime.
What a crime. Whatever. She didn't have to necessarily serve any prison sentencing for that. But what's crazy, though, is like when I was like going through the Wikipedia article and like checking all the sources, like I was able to find the articles from like the 40s of like, oh, like the writer, the ex-wife has been charged for this and this. So it was really scandalous and a really big deal. Wow. And I think, you know, always just goes to show the fame that she did have, that it was like full on display what had happened here. I thought this paragraph was interesting. Like her fiction, Parrott's life was not without its marital disruptions and scandals. Wed and divorced four times, she found herself hauled into court in 1943 for helping a young soldier escape from military prison. What's more, the soldier was accused of trafficking in marijuana. Parrott was also reportedly the victim of numerous attempts at blackmail. In 1953, she was again in the news when, as Time magazine reported, her hotel presented a $225 bill and she refused to accept her check. She spent 30 hours in jail in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, with her French poodle Coco. And then also apparently like a friend later like sued her for stealing her silverware or something. Like I said, the information we have is very disjointed. She ended up passing away in 1957 at the age of 58 due to cancer. She died in just a hospital in New York City. So that's pretty much what I was able to find about her personal life. I'm going to go into a lot more about her work now because, I mean, generally, that's what I like to focus on anyways. But like I mentioned, her first novel, Ex-Wife, was published anonymously in 1929. It was a popular sensation almost immediately, and it sold more than 100,000 copies. What's cool is that MGM paid $20,000 for the film rights as well. And it was adapted for the film, as I mentioned, called The Divorcee. It came out in 1930, starring Norma Shearer, who won an Oscar for her role. She also starred in an adaptation of Strangers May Kiss, published in 1930. Her novel, Next Time We Live, was adapted for film as Next Time We Love. And as a writer, she was most successful between 1929 and 1940. Her son estimated that she earned around $700,000, but the equivalency in 2022 dollars is $14.6 million.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. Whew. And what's crazy is she was doing this in the 30s, which...
Yeah.
Is not historically an economically great time for the United States. And she was making so much money from the movie studios and because her books were just doing so well. That $14 million equivalency. I don't think we've covered someone who's actually was that financially successful from their works.
I don't think so. I mean, it's hard with like conversion rates. So like, correct us if, I don't know, you kept track of every person we've covered.
No, but I don't think so.
Insane.
Like, I know we've had people who've like reached success and reached fame, and I'm sure like the movie stars, you know, maybe hit some type of equivalency, but like...
But no one from the past that we've like, that's a lot of money.
Like now an unsung name that no one even really knows.
Yeah, that's insane.
I know. I was very shocked to read that. But I want to talk a little bit more about the ex-wife. So like I mentioned, it tells the tale of Pat and Peter, a married couple in their 20s who are convinced that they don't need to follow the rules in the pursuit of marital bliss. But when Peter, who has strayed, learned that Pat has done the same, just once, by the way, in a tipsy moment of emotional weakness, his attitudes towards her is no longer so modern. And the rest of the book is devoted to Pat or Patricia coming to terms with her new status as an ex-wife, which it was really interesting to me, like how character driven it was and also truly just how modern it felt. I felt like I was reading things that I was like, oh, like it was so shocking to me that this was 100 years ago that this book came out. I mean, even in the sense that like within the first 40 pages of the book, the main character has an abortion.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why, it's really tragic that she gets pregnant and she thinks, awesome, he'll stay with me. My husband will stay with me. And he throws her through a glass door and says, get an abortion. And so she does. And so it's very, very sad. But it's also, to me, like it just felt so, not jarring necessarily, but I was just actually very surprised how candidly like she was writing about this. You know, when you open a book that came out in 1930, you don't expect to like read about abortion within the first couple pages, you know?
Yeah.
It was really interesting. And then to continue on with the plot of it, she like moves in with a roommate who is also divorced. And so it's kind of like tells the tale of the two of them. A lot of it's like them having lunches or going out to bars or speakeasies together, drinking and like discussing the problems of being an ex-wife, going on dates and like all the men that she dates after. But in the end, I think it does reach some type of happy conclusion where she finds peace in her life. And, you know, I don't want to give it away because you have to read it, but it was really good. This is from The New Yorker. I really liked these couple paragraphs. So it says, in the summer of 1929, a provocative New York novel titled Ex-Wife arrived in bookstores, quickly selling out of its first printing. Walter Winchell, the gossip columnist and radio host, called it a sensational book about husbands and sex. Which, what I thought was interesting is that, like I mentioned, it was published anonymously, but that wasn't uncommon, actually. And they did it for like as a marketing gimmick at the time.
Oh,
so okay. I wonder if it was almost like a way to like signify like, ooh, this is scandalous and this is new because they don't even want to put their name on it. Okay. Like, it's so dirty or whatever, so shocking that you don't even know who wrote it. But the author was actually soon outed in the gossip columnist Winchell's newspaper column as Ursula Parrott, a 30-year-old first-time novelist, the daughter of a respected Boston physician, a Radcliffe graduate, and a single mother of a young son, and a verified ex-wife.
I don't know why it's funny to me that they're like, and she actually is divorced.
Yeah, exactly. There was also a tabloid called The Daily Mirror, called it the most talked about story of the day, with a full page ad prominently featuring Parrott's name and her pixie cut likeness. No longer tantalizing readers by shrouding Parrott's identity in mystery, the marketers of Ex-Wife now strive to make the attractive young author synonymous with her creation, insinuating that her novel was a barely veiled memoir. Fiction or confession, a headline asked. In October of 1929, amid the stock market crash that precipitated the Great Depression, Parrott received her first royalty check for the modern equivalency of almost $300,000.
That is the way to plan your life out, to get your first royalty check right as the Great Depression hits.
Yeah. Yeah. It's honestly shocking. And I mean, sure, it sounds like that they definitely pushed the whole like, is it true or is it not true as a marketing gimmick? But I mean, I read the book first and then I learned about her. And the more I learned about her, the more I'm like, it makes sense that this woman wrote The Ex-Wife. Like, it seemed like she drew a lot from her own personal experiences. But like, of course you do. Like, that's what authors do.
Yeah, I think like everyone does. And I think you can debate that with a lot of people on whether or not it was
like what that line is.
Yeah.
To continue on with referencing that New Yorker article, at a time in the U.S. when the stigma of divorce was fading and divorce rates were rising, accordingly, Ex-Wife presented readers and critics with a new woman, one who is pursuing new vocational, economic, and romantic freedoms. She spent her days chasing a career while her nights were a boozy smear of restaurants, speakeasies, and amorous encounters. She was exciting and discomfiting and morally questionable. She was confusing to her suitors, some of whom found her at once repellent and irresistible. And so I actually did kind of like that. The main character was unlikable. She was hopelessly in love with this ex-husband that I was like, goodness gracious, get over him. He sucks.
Been there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But at the same time, like, my point in saying that is it was so relatable, though. You know, like, because
makes me feel like I'm doing divorce wrong. I can say that much. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, you need to go get drunk a lot and you'll be doing it just like Patty over here is. Oh, then this is a line from Patricia, the narrator, is a copywriter for a Manhattan department store, but also a type, a species, one that varies in quality and breeding. The grade A version, per Patricia, sex appeal, dresses well, looks young, dances lightly, can make wise cracks, and is self-supporting, lets a man talk, does not gold dig except for another round of liquors after dinner, never passes out or gets rushes or gets sick. So that's the woman she's striving to be. We're going to take a quick break just to spotlight one of our new favorite women artists.
The person I want to spotlight today is an interior decorator. Her name is Haley Stewart, and her username is I Am Haley Stewart. That's Haley spelled H-A-Y-L-E-Y. I know people spell that a million ways. Her bio says like DIY and globally inspired interiors. Mm-hmm. She actually has connections through like a couple of different places. She has like a tile collection that she did through this company called Maitland and Pote. And then she also has a lampshade collection through Tinker and Tallulah. Yes. and it's her first reel actually that's on there right now, is her lampshade collection. There is fringe, there is velvet, there are patterns, they are beautiful. Like, a talk about maximalist decor.
Oh, I love a good maximalist decor.
I'm in love.
This is amazing. Yeah, I love the fringe.
Yes, her tiles are the same. Like, they're colorful, they're beautiful, they look hand painted, which is gorgeous. And then she just has like pictures of her house, like painting her pool, stenciling her doors.
Oh my gosh, this really is amazing. I just want my house to look like this one day.
This is literally what I'm like, oh man, I would love it to just like pay someone to come in and be like, okay, make it look like this.
This is exactly what I want. Please and thank you.
Yeah, it's literally just gorgeous.
I love this so much.
Yeah, and kind of like a shout out to our past episode of like, is the world losing color? And we talked a lot about how global decor has lots of color, whereas like European decor, westernization is getting like really black and white and beige. So it's just fun to see someone actually making their surroundings like colorful and pretty and embracing that.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. I love it.
Check her out. She's got a bunch of stuff. So, I mean, you can go buy it and make your own home beautiful.
Amazing. My spotlight for today, the Instagram page is Cords Club, C-O-R-D-S Club, Cords Club.
I've seen them.
Yay. So I actually like went to college with her, kind of. I mean, we lived in the same apartment complex. Admittedly, I didn't really know her very well, but you know, knew who she was, liked her, of course. Anyways, but she started this earring company, and like, I've been following the earring company forever because I followed it when she created it. Like, I knew her well enough to be like, cool, I'm gonna support this, you know?
Yeah.
But it's so cool to like have watched it explode. The caption is like, make jewelry fun again, earring for sensitive ears. And like, another thing that she talks a lot about is like, the earrings have flat backs, so then that way it doesn't poke you, which is also great for sleeping.
It's so nice. Mm-hmm. I leave my earrings in 24/7. Like, I actually don't take them out. So flat backs are like, the hoops that don't have a back are absolutely essential to me. So I love it when I find jewelry companies that do that, because then I will buy them.
I love it so much. And I just love jewelry that's feminine and flirty. And there's a lot of daisies with, which if anyone has been here a while, you would know that I have an artist named Daisy, which means I do a lot of fun stuff with this. So go check her out. Go buy some cute, dainty little jewelry from her. Again, that's Cords Club. And her name is Lexi. All right, now back to the show. A fun little side note that I kind of drew conclusion to. I was just like searching for other authors of like, okay, who else is like an author in New York, you know, or just like trying to find some connection. And I thought about Sex and the City, and Sex and the City tells the tale of like a modern woman in the city dating and striving for career while also her romantic endeavors. And I feel like this book was kind of the 1930s version of Sex and the City.
Yeah.
Where it was like the story of a new modern woman who is embracing divorce, who is drinking and out on the town and, you know, buying herself clothes and has a career, her navigating divorce and everything. And I mean, for one thing, she's literally like a writer. And think about how many rom-coms take place where the woman is a writer in New York trying to like figure out the problems of love and life. And she even has like the roommate best friend who's like the snarky roommate who like gives her little advice. And it feels like this is almost like the beginning of the blueprint of the modern rom-com.
Yeah.
And so it's fun to kind of see like, oh, the trope of, you know, woman in New York trying to find herself, it's been around for a very long time. And I don't know if Ursula Parrott did it first or if hers was the first one to get very popular.
Well, the thing you read did mention that divorce was just becoming like non-stigmatized.
Yeah.
Though I guess some of the other ones don't really talk about divorce, but that is kind of like a very feminist turn of the century situation. So
maybe we can owe all chick flicks to Ursula Parrott, you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't
I'm
be
okay with that.
Yeah, sure. I'm okay with that too. I love this quote about it too. Francine Prose, who is an author, she did the introduction in the 1989 reissue of Ex-Wife. She wrote, "It's striking how much of Ex-Wife seems far less dated than many of F. Scott Fitzgerald's Jazz Age stories." And it's true. Pat's daily life comes off as remarkably similar to those led by so many urban women today.
That's
as I
cool.
said, draws line very closely. So another critic was shocked by the protagonist for not so much for her recklessness or her endurance. If half an hour a day in the gymnasium and a diet of scotch will produce all the energy that the heroine of Ex-Wife dissipates so gaily, the regimen is well worth investigating.
I'm telling you, we're doing life wrong.
That quote made me laugh.
Oh man, that is so funny.
And then this last thing I want to read is, "The answer to fiction or confession was both. Ex-Wife is recognizably a novel, one that begins with the end of a marriage and ends with the beginning of another. That drew heavily on Parrott's life. A one-night stand with her husband's colleague prompted the collapse of her first marriage. A passionate love affair ensued with the married newspaper reporter Hugh O'Connor, and clear stand-in for the Noel of Ex-Wife." The book is actually dedicated to H and transcribes a snippet of one of O'Connor's love letters to Parrott. Fun fact. She underwent at least 4 abortions, 3 of them during her relationship with O'Connor, and the last of which left her with persistent health complications. So there was a lot in her own life that did mirror her writing, which, I mean, like we said, of course, like, I don't know any artist or author who doesn't, but it's like, no wonder she could write so candidly about the modern woman, is because that's what she was writing, and she was just writing what she knew. I mentioned it at the beginning, but like during my research, from when I started to end it, there was a new article or a new blog post that Marcia Gordon, who was the biographer who wrote the book, and she wrote this article on lithub.com, and it's "Women on the Verge, the Jazz Age Origins of Burnout." And I thought that this was like maybe a cool way to end, because relatable. I mean, at the beginning of this episode and before we started recording, we were bemoaning the fact that we have to work and we are trying to figure out how we can give our all to this podcast that we want to and our own passion projects. And you know what? It's just really hard to balance all of it,
really,
as well as personal life and relationships. And sometimes it feels like you can only pick like 2. Maybe.
Yep.
Like 2 things can be going really awesome. Doesn't really seem like anything else can. And I have more than 2 things I want to do. So that's frustrating.
Same.
So I really resonated with this article. So the article starts out with this, which was a quote from Ursula herself. "I have a theory," the writer Ursula Parrott mused in a late 1920s letter, in which she wonders if she should accept an advertising position at Arnold Constable's Fifth Avenue store, which, you know, Fifth Avenue. Bougie. She continues, "that it's perfectly possible to manage a job and one other thing well, but no more than that. The trouble usually is that one tries to manage a job and about 4 other things, and 3 of them go wrong."
I feel called out.
Exactly. And, you know, I felt a lot of sympathy for Ursula in those moments of reading this, where I'm like, she gets it. And like we mentioned, like, she was among the first wave of college-educated working women who could choose to be single, whether that was like being widowed or divorced. And she, after leaving a demanding job writing advertising copy to dedicate herself to becoming an author in 1928, she came to the conclusion that she and women like her could really not have it all, to borrow, you know, that popular mantra that was later introduced. And that theme really was so prevalent throughout all of her books. I'm only mentioning Ex-Wife because that is the one I've read and the one that was like most popular. But in 1929, she released Leftover Ladies, a nonfiction treatise that she actually published alongside her novel that was published the same year. And in that Leftover Ladies, she wrote about how impossible it was to be a successful career woman and have a successful marriage and be a parent and travel and maintain one health and figure and keep up social obligations. And then, quote, "simply because there is a limit to the amount of vitality a woman has to expend altogether. The appendix that a career afforded also has a cost."
That makes me feel better.
It does. It like made me feel good to read this book and learn about her, where it's just like, you know what? Like, I'm feeling so connected to this person that lived 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of it's validating, but in the sense that I'm like, why is society still making me live this way?
Well, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I feel like we've talked about this before. I don't know if we've done it on here, but just like, you see people online and they like exercise and cook and all of their meals, and they like have careers and then they have families and they just do all of it. And it's just like, how?
Yeah.
You know, like, that's mm-hmm. just not possible. Like, I don't know how anyone could possibly be doing all of that successfully all of the time.
I know. I mean, and that's such a thing with, it's like you said, like Instagram and even just like coming out here to Nashville. And, you know, I've had to work full time out of truly necessity. And I'm really thankful for my job. But sometimes I look at other songwriters and I'm just like, how are you doing? How are you surviving? And it's none of my business. And it's so easy to like want to judge myself of just being like, well, how are you surviving? How am I not surviving? But the point is there's just like so much going on in the background of people's lives. And if you think people are doing it all, they're not. There's something that is not there that they're not doing. That's not to put them down at all. No. Like, that's not what I'm trying to do.
I think it's like to just kind of put us all in the same playing field in a way, to just be like, there's always something that's suffering if you're attempting to do everything. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to accomplish.
And not to be like pessimistic about it, but more of just like, don't be so hard on yourself if you can't give everything you love 100% all of the time.
Wouldn't that be nice though?
It would. And I love to fool myself and keep thinking that I can. And I keep proving to myself that I cannot.
I also, this is kind of relevant, I saw like a quote this week that was like, can we stop saying we have the same hours in the day as Beyonce? We don't.
We don't.
She has like a personal trainer, a personal chef, a business manager, like probably multiple project managers, a nanny, like a driver. Like, imagine how much more time you would have if every mindless task that could be offboarded to someone else was taken away from you.
Yeah. You'd have so much time to do the things
like,
you love.
I spent half an hour today cleaning my house. If I had a maid, that's half an hour I could be doing something else. Literally. You know, like, there's just...
Truly. My whole morning was spent going to the MDV and then getting my car registered and like doing all those things.
Oh, true. Yeah. Yesterday I spent like 2 hours just driving and going to the doctor.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Oh my God.
How much quicker if the doctor just came to your house, or if you didn't even have to go, they just like, I don't know, knew what was going on with you.
Beyonce doesn't even need doctors anymore.
She might not. They just like look at her and they're like, okay.
Literally. She's like not even human anymore in my mind. It's like on a whole other level. But no, seriously, like I really love that, because I think that hearing that, that used to be something that was really discouraging years ago when I heard like, oh, you have the same amount of hours in the day. It's like, yeah, that's... Yeah. So true. And like, what am I doing? I'm wasting my time. Where it's like, actually, I have to take care of everything. So
yeah, you're running your entire life, and no offense to Beyonce, but a lot of her life has been taken care of, so that the things that she wants to focus on take priority.
And not even
what money buys you.
Yeah, not even to pick on Beyonce or other women, like any multimillionaire billionaire, they've got so many people helping them and doing all the annoying things that we have to do every single day of our lives.
Yeah.
So,
and that's what money buys. It buys time.
Money
time
does
very valuable.
Buy time, absolutely. Just to summarize, give a shout out to a couple more of her works. She wrote a novella called Breadwinner, which tells the story of a girl whose life gets caught up between the two milestones of emotion and ambition. There was a novel called Next Time We Live, where she actually tells the story of a married couple who both like reach the top of their fields, but because of their work, they live in different countries. And the wife, her name's Cicely, like she basically just raises the children alone. But then 12 years into their marriage, where they're actually only occasionally seeing each other, she goes to Italy to visit her husband, who's on the verge of dying from tuberculosis. And she delivers the novel's final line, which is, "Next time we live, Christopher, we'll have time for each other." The point that she made, though, was she doesn't necessarily like condemn her career ambitions. It's more of just like, there is no blame. It's just kind of like an acknowledgement of like, this is just what happens when people are focused on their ambition. And I think like Ursula was pessimistic and also maybe in a way right, that it's like sometimes like it is one or the other, so choose wisely, kind of a thing. This is also a quote that she wrote from that last article. "Several months before she became a best-selling author who would spend the next 2 decades writing as much as she could, Parrott had the kind of idea that often comes after a night of ample cocktails. Half joking, but fully bunned, as she liked to say, she told her lover at the time that she had finally figured out a career for herself. Open a speakeasy for tired businesswomen." What she dreamed up, "When I wanted to go to have a poor dinner and couldn't think of a place where I wouldn't be stared at. And then her mock business proposal went on to describe the woman's speakeasy as having all of the worst features of a pub in a tea room, serve chicken patties and sweet cocktails, and have a ward for those who passed out and a lethal chamber for those who got sick. I'd run that. The best part, that she could drink up all the profits. I feel like that's something that women want now, is a place that they can just go, blow some steam, and not be bothered by men. Yeah. So you know what? History, we're not so different from it.
I mean, I guess if the world never changes, the desires don't either.
Exactly. I do briefly, you know, just want to acknowledge the fact that, like, she was a very flawed woman. She doesn't call herself a feminist, and, like, some critiques of her work would maybe say that, like, almost like she's condemning the working woman of saying, like, see, look, this is what I have to deal with. But, like, she wishes for the life that, like, her grandma or mother had, where it's like there was just a man taking care of her and her job was just to be a mom. I mean, that's not a bad thing to want to be a mom at all. And so I don't necessarily think it's, like, a bad thing that, you know, she would have wanted that, of course.
I almost think, like, you kind of have to look at her circumstances too, where, like, she has a kid and her husband leaves her because of it. Then maybe there was some desire there to be like, well, I was forced into the life of, like, a working single mother.
Yeah, and that's not the life I wanted. And yeah. Then I'm sure there's, like, so much bitterness of, like, she doesn't really necessarily have a relationship with her son.
Yeah.
But she's, like, earning money for him. Also, at the end of her life, she didn't really have any of her money left. She sounds like she basically blew through it. So I don't really know if, like, her son was, like, left any amount of money. That's not necessarily condemning her. It's just, you know, she was a flawed woman. Some people point out, like, there's maybe a couple moments of slight anti-Semitism in her novel, too, that, you know,
we mirrored don't condone that.
Some attitudes at the time. So, yeah, that's what I want to acknowledge, of, like, I am speaking very highly of the book. I would still recommend reading it. I don't agree with every conclusion that the characters come to in the book, but in a way, it did feel very modern, and the musings felt very current to, you know, similar things that I'll almost, like, gossip and just, like, talk about with my own girlfriends sometimes, like, bemoaning life and existence. So,
yeah,
I would definitely recommend it. And I wanted to end with this last paragraph that was done by, like I said, Marcia Gordon, who wrote this biography. But she said, Parrot has not been read or taught in classrooms for many years, but I hope that her surprisingly relevant tales, now almost a century old, find their way to a new generation of readers, especially women who are still struggling, and I think largely failing to figure out how to avoid the particular variety of burnout that afflicts women, which Parrot perceived as a side effect of the equal everything. Sex, booze, morality, work, jazz age. I thought that was a appropriate way to end the episode. Anyways, so there is Ursula Parrot. Like I said, a brief introduction to a very fun and complicated woman. And I hope to read that biography soon, because
when does it come out?
I want to learn. It is out, actually. Oh, okay. It was published just a couple months ago, though. Like I said, we're in the midst of a hopeful beginning of a renaissance. So I'm glad that we can be a part of it. And
cool. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for being here and for listening. Of course, we'll be back next week with an episode. So catch us then. And good night. And farewell.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.